The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Good afternoon, Catherine Thomas in for Ray today. How are you keeping? Happy Monday. Hope all is good. 51551 or ray@rte.ie to get in touch and join in the chats. I'd love to hear from you. So hope you had a nice weekend. I spent most of last week and all day Saturday driving around the country and jumping out from behind hedges and popping up at work, surprising the new Operation Transformation leaders. And I think we're going to have a great gang this year, I have to say. Mind you, I say that every year. But I'm heading to Cork tomorrow to sit down and interview our first ever couple on the series, Barry and Andrea, which I'm looking forward to. They're so lovely. And there's a healthy dose of competition between them as well, which I think is going to make things interesting as the weeks go on. And you know what? We've all been saying on the production team, how have we not thought about doing this before? Because our partners' eating habits definitely affect our own and vice versa, don't they? I mean, if one person in a house is trying to lose weight and the other is chowing down on wagon wheel pizzas, it makes it hell of a lot more difficult. So I'd love to know how you're managing it in your house, if that applies to you at the moment, or if one person in your house tries to lose weight and nobody else is at that particular time, can it be a nightmare? Has it led to arguments in your house? How have you figured out a coping mechanism that works for everybody involved? Let me know, 51551 or ray@rte.ie. And look, at this time of the year is so difficult, it can be a nightmare if you're trying to lose weight, just because the sweets and the ads on the telly and every shelf and every screen and every newspaper is just all about like the all the bits that we love at Christmas. And if you've parties to go to and catch ups and work Christmas parties and kids parties, it can be overwhelming for you. So look, my one tip this time of the year is to save those extra calories and enjoy them with people that you actually like. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's no point in saying I'm not going out, or I can't go out, or I'm not going to this function, because you don't want to cut yourself off either. But I would just say, you know, sometimes you end up at functions standing around with people that you wouldn't necessarily call your friends. Step away from the vol-au-vents, step away from the sweets, and step away from the wine, and, you know, enjoy that on the Friday night when you're out with the girls or when you're out with your family. Easier said than done, I know. What else? Yes, Michael Fry on Twitter. He caught my eye today because I think we've all been there. He tweeted, "My regular place was full yesterday, so I decided to risk going to the bad barbers, thinking this time would somehow be different. He cut my hair in 10 minutes and I said I liked it. It's absolute dog shit. I hate myself." And in fairness to him, the photo attached is enough proof. God love him. It is not the nicest haircut in the world. And we were chatting about it because I think everybody has a bad hair story, a bad hair colour story. I have to say, none worse than my own father when we were about seven. He used to line us all up outside so he wouldn't have to sweep up the bits of fringe afterwards. So he'd cut our hair, all of us lined up outside with a paper scissors. So we all had these fringes. In the photographs, when you look back, it just looks like a dog has chewed them. Anyway, we were chatting about it. And Niamh on the team here said last week she couldn't get an appointment with her own hairdressers. And sure, this time of the year, unless you've booked months in advance, it's so difficult to get in. So she went to a different hairdresser's down the road who made an absolute hames of it. In her words, of course, us like supportive colleagues are going, "You look beautiful. It's fabulous." But she said she walked out. She said thank you to the hairdresser who'd made a hames of it. And she went down the road, opened the door and burst out crying in front of her own hairdresser. And I said, "Why didn't you complain?" And she said she couldn't deal with the mortification of it. And she also didn't want the same person fixing what was already a bad situation. So look, at I think it goes back to that whole thing, that Irish thing about not wanting to complain. We're useless. So I'd love to hear from you. Have you had similar experiences? What is the worst hair experience that you've had to go through? And you know what? I'd love if you're a hairdresser, I'd love if you could let us know, because it is difficult to complain, I think, when you're sitting in that chair and you could have been there for 2 hours getting a colour done. If you're not happy, how do you complain? What's the best way to go about it? And surely to God, I mean, we all have bad days. Surely a hairdresser, especially this time of the year, you're busy, you're working all the hours, you have a bad day. Like, you know, if you even want to come on anonymously and admit to giving somebody a bad haircut or colour, 51551 or ray@rte.ie. And then this is completely selfish. I just need to know for myself. And this is for the fellas out there. Lads, how many times do you get the haircut? I want to know, because my husband, I think he goes every week. He says I exaggerate. He says it's 2 weeks to 3 weeks. I'm sure it's more than that. He goes to his great barber. His friend, his name is Billy. He loves going to the barbers. And then he'd kind of come back and go, well, you know, I got my hair cut. And he gets annoyed because I haven't commented on it. I said, you've just got it cut 6 days ago. So I just want to know for myself, what's the average time for a man to go to the hairdressers? I know it depends on the hair, but anyway, I think he loves the ritual of the barber and the whole experience more so than actually the necessity of getting it done. Anyway, what time are we now? So it's 3:10 in the afternoon. According to a new study, if you're feeling groggy now in the afternoon, it could be to do with the fact that maybe you're getting out of bed before 7:55 a.m. A genetic company called 23andMe have found if we get up any earlier than that and face straight into a long commute, you're essentially wasting your employer's time to the tune of 1 hour and 22 minutes a day through tiredness. They go on to say that people are basically working on autopilot for 3 out of every 5 working days. So essentially, we're doing everyone a service if we get up after 5 to 8 in the morning. I mean, yes, that's great in an ideal world. Not the real world that most of us live in. And actually, that reminds me, I read a piece today in The Examiner, communications queen Terry Prone. She has an article on sleep and it's all about how sleep deprivation causes all sorts of other major health problems. But the one thing that stuck out for me is this business. It seems that she wants to get into bed with Mattress Mick. And I mean that in a business sense. So she's reading this book at the moment called Why We Sleep. And it talks about the benefits of the ancient practice of rocking a baby to sleep, which apparently increases the depth of deep sleep and boosts the quality of slow brainwaves. And so she's kind of saying that she'd love to get into it because nobody has designed this bed that would rock us slowly to sleep. Regardless of whether this bed actually happens, I just can imagine Terry Prone and Mattress Mick, I can imagine the ads around this bed. Imagine the two of them in bed together selling these beds. I just think it would be a PR work of genius. She says, we have beds with memory foam mattresses that register our shape as we lie in them, producing for no good reason versions of the body outlines detectives used to make around the corpses of the recently murdered. We have beds that can have their heads and tails raised. You can be half sitting up or you can have your legs dangling in the air like a happy Labrador. We have water beds, beds that vibrate, but beds that rock us to sleep slowly, there are none. So there you go. Do you like the idea? Would it appeal to you or would it make you sick? Imagine if you had a hangover. Not so sure about that. And we are obsessed with our beds. I am obsessed with my bed, and particularly this time of year when we're all trying to stave off colds and flus, you know, having the nice bed to get into and the clean sheets and the whole thing. So let me know, what is the best thing about your bed? And also, what would you feel about a rocking bed? And also, how would you feel about Terry Prone and Mattress Mick getting into bed together, doing a duet? Who knows? It could be a Christmas number one. Speaking of Christmas, let me know if you saw Frozen 2 this weekend. The biggest ever opening weekend for an animated film, and it's set to become the number one film globally. What did it take in at the Irish box office this weekend? €1.9 million. Ah, it's a juggernaut, isn't it? Let me know. Were you there? Was it worth it? 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Text coming in here on haircuts. I had a Van Gogh moment at the barber's. She cut the bloody ear off me. I was spouting blood, so I had to complain. Well, definitely in that situation. Catherine, I read recently there's a chronic shortage of hairdressers or barbers, in particular due to the popularity of Peaky Blinders-inspired haircuts. There you go. Operation Transformation. Kay, what about people who just have a little bit of weight to lose but can't move it from our middle? Probably eating the wrong food for belly fat. Can there be any part of OT to cover this? Well, we've got lots of things on Operation Transformation this year. But it's very hard to target specific areas for weight loss. But anyway, we will be going into all of that and more in the new series. So keep your text coming in, 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Let's get some Irish music. That is Wild Youth. I love that guy's voice. It is absolutely brilliant. We were talking about haircuts and dodgy haircuts earlier on. When I was 18, I got a perm in a different hairdresser's, a local small one. And I'm not joking you, I came out as if I was 70. It looked like a set perm your granny got years ago that was 35 years ago. I ran home, washed it and put it up in a ponytail for about 6 weeks. Never let anyone see it properly. Worst hairdo ever, says Sinead in Kildare. Yeah, I think we've all done that. Run out of the hairdresser, said thanks very much, paid €150 and then tie it up in the L ponytail. Anyway, keep them coming in. Keep them coming in. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Also, just to say, later on in the programme, we are going to be talking to two moms about a resource available to first-time moms, to new moms. So if you are a new mom or you are a first-time mom, we'll be looking at a new online resource that's now available for you. It's completely free of charge. And if you have any questions, Dr. Deirdre Daly, who's the assistant professor in midwifery at Trinity College, she will also be here to answer any questions you may have if you're in those first couple of days or those first couple of weeks, which where it's all your emotions, everything, your whole world has changed. So any questions, you can get them into us, 51551 or ray@rte.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, joining me in studio is Helena Tuberty. Helena is a fertility coach and through her work helps people through fertility treatments, pregnancy, birth and pregnancy loss. 11 years ago, her family suffered their own loss when her daughter Carla took her life at just 17. And Helena is here to talk to me about her experiences at the time and how really her work has helped her. So thank you so much for coming in and talking to me today. And I was saying to you during the ad break that I know that this is not an easy conversation to talk about. And I just want to say, if there's anything that I ask you that you're not comfortable answering, that's cool as well. I'm good with that. So I suppose let's start talking and let's start with Carla. I believe she was an incredibly warm person.
Absolutely. The centre of our home and hearth. She was a superb cook and an amazing baker, which she certainly did not get from her mother. And, you know, she really was full of life, very involved. We were very involved in scouting. She was the youngest on the medical team. She was busy doing quite a lot of serious subjects coming into fifth year. And, you know, it became a little bit overwhelming. She was being excluded amongst her friend group. And we kind of thought a good idea would be take a break because she wasn't actually doing transition year, which I think is a good idea. And
so she went straight from third to into fifth.
She went from junior cert to fifth.
Yeah.
And, you know, so she did take time out. And of course, just at the outset, because people, you know, they still look at me and say, well, how did you miss it, Helena? I did. You know, she appeared absolutely fine. I did bring her to our GP, who smiled and laughed and shook her hand and said, well, there's no depression here. So do you know what I mean?
That, and there wasn't. Do you believe that there was? Or?
Well, really, none that was tangible to us, none that we recognised. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes there is that feeling of people feeling that you have misdiagnosed, you've lost, you know, you haven't been the proper parent. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stigma. Mm-hmm. And as I was saying to you earlier, that stigma that I think we have problems dealing with death. There is a hierarchy of suicide being the lowest form of, you know, teen death. Even though I come from a cluster area in Meath, there were a lot of suicide deaths around the time.
Is like that what, life. Explain to me a cluster area.
Cluster, I know it sounds so technical and so hard, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, a cluster area is where a few people, there are significant, you know, sort of above the sort of general expectation where there are several deaths. One of the similarities or the commonalities was people who had moved to the area from outside.
Okay.
Who had kind of gone up through school, up through the ranks. But, you know, the sense that how difficult it is to integrate into a society, into an area. Mm. And I think, I suppose one of my main points is that I have never wished to be defined by her death.
Of course.
I don't rattle boxes. I haven't climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. I haven't done anything like that. I think the sense of initiatives are all very well, and sort of help after the event, perhaps. But I do think our common kindness. I mean, I was upstairs and there was a group having a conversation and I was very much on my own there. And I was really quite amused because, you know, they were so exclusive. And so, you know, the sense that a smile, a word would have been a lovely thing. Mm-hmm. And it is just the sense that as a nation, our kindness and our warmth to strangers has been a little bit eroded, I feel. Mm-hmm. And it can make a huge difference. In my town, the shopkeepers have always been very friendly, very helpful. And it is those odd moments of connection that human beings thrive with.
And did Carla talk to you about a lack of those connections, about feeling ostracised?
She was feeling ostracised. Her friends were, I suppose, just beginning to do teen things, and she was feeling very left out. And it was very unusual because she had supported friends through actual depressions. Mm-hmm. And she had always been very much sort of the mummy, the very capable person. And, you know, she was sidelined completely. And that is tough when you're a teen. It's tough at any age, as I was just saying.
And so when she said to you that I want to leave school, that I want to take the time out, you fully supported her. You thought that that was the right thing to do, even though I know you're so education, you're so pro-education and
Absolutely.
Learning and all of that, especially in your field of
yes,
work.
Yes, of course. I mean, I'm a lifelong learner, and that has actually been a wonderful support to me in, you know, coming through in learning to live with this. But certainly to take some time out, it just seemed like the right thing. Carla was very switched on. She wasn't a moody teen. She wasn't sort of slamming bedroom doors. She was a lovely person to live with.
And the day before it happened, you had been shopping, you'd been out. Suzanne is her little sister. It was a completely normal day.
It seemed absolutely normal. We actually were shopping for holiday clothes. We were going on the annual vacation, which I presumed would be the last one, you know, it was a family vacay. And we bought bikinis, you know. It was, so that's why, you know, the sense of shock was absolutely massive. In retrospect, of course, one spends a lot of grieving, a lot of mourning is about cataloguing. It's about going over everything. And I suppose for me, that was something I didn't want to skimp. There is, and I meet it in my own work, that people are very much into a band-aid approach. You know, go and get counselling, get over this, get beyond it. And I think sometimes we need to acknowledge that the overt griefs, I mean, our town was besieged. It was a very public event, which was kind of difficult for introverts to live with, you know, the sense of being the centre of attention. To have time to process, to grieve, to, I suppose, give the time, you know, it is a process.
Yeah.
And not to rush it. And I think in my work, it's something I see. I mean, I help people navigate IVF, and there is a very high miscarriage rate that is very hidden. It's kind of under the bracket of it didn't work. Mm-hmm. But the sense of actually losing a pregnancy, however early, however it may seem tentative, can be dismissed. Well, you know, it's like 2 weeks ago now, it's a month ago, it's 6 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Are you going again? What's the next plan?
Oh, and my God.
People think they're forward projecting you, and it's not actually helpful.
I know. And I've lived that. And, you know, I went through my own experience with multiple miscarriage, with fertility issues. And I think sometimes, and I don't know if you, if and I hope I'm not speaking out of turn when I say this, I think sometimes people don't know what to say, you know. It's, you know, oh, time is a great healer, or, you know, whatever is meant to be will be. Do you feel that when people said that to you about Carla, how do you put them in the same category? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Do you?
OK. We're very clumsy about what we say.
I just think people don't know what to say. And half the time I find myself in that situation. I mean, I would even coming in and talking to you about something as massive and as heartbreaking and as devastating as losing your daughter, I think we sometimes just don't know what to say.
I think now, and it's wonderful, I mean, I'm so grateful to Jen Hogan. She's a wonderful writer.
Yeah, Jen wrote the piece
in
the Irish Times.
She wrote the piece beautifully. She spent time listening to me. She, you know, wrote so beautifully, so eloquently, and she stayed in touch with me. You know, the day it was published, the day it went online beforehand. I mean, she really is, you know, a sterling writer. And I think the Irish Times Health is doing a magnificent job of talking about all of these taboo or sensitive areas. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I suppose, as I said, I'd never wanted to be defined by it. I'd seen how other mothers had coped in our town. There were different, obviously different coping mechanisms.
And everybody may have different ways of coping.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And certainly the sense of the language that people use, or the reflexive, you know, knee-jerk reactions that people have, You know, for an atheist being told you have an angel in heaven as if this is the best thing you could wish for, it's like, well, you know, thank you. And of course, you learn to smile. And as my daughter Suzanne and I would say, you know, there was a feeling of you would have to smile and swallow and just take whatever anyone was saying. And you, there was no question of ever coming back to somebody and saying, well, you know, is that the most helpful thing? Mm-hmm. And I think if we ask, you know, the sense of the people, I think it was very much a middle class thing as well. Very class orientated. Middle class people are terrified by things as kind of, you know, catching or tainted as grief. Whereas people who might have other backgrounds were much more direct and the sense of it is horrendous. It is a tragedy. You poor thing. How are you? What can I do? I don't know what to say. And that I felt was so honest, so open and so accommodating. You know, mm-hmm. it really, it left a space, you know, an interface in which we could react on that minute to minute. You know, it may not last, you know, a moment of the sense of tears prickling at the eyes doesn't necessarily spiral into some sort of half an hour of, gosh, I've got to cancel this person. Mm-hmm. Just the acknowledgement mm-hmm. is really useful.
Do you find that when people didn't know what to say, like after the funeral, did you have people who didn't contact you, who moved out of your life, who kind of stayed away to some
degree? Absolutely.
Did you?
I found about 3 years, it was like the Shawshank Redemption, that we had done our time and we were now rehabilitated to society with certain people. Others, I found myself that I couldn't be near because they were, you know, the sense of the, again, the self-reflexive thing. I'm so devastated. I'm so horrified. And I felt I was having to deal with their grief, which I couldn't. I was the bereaved mother of a bereaved child mm-hmm. with a bereaved partner. And, you know, we were finding our own way.
Sorry to interrupt you. Just going back. How did you deal with your shock? How did you as a family deal with the shock and the aftermath of grief?
In our own way. And that was, I suppose, we didn't have the sort of religious markering of time.
Okay.
That, although my daughter, Carla, actually was a Roman Catholic and she had actually been to confession the week beforehand, which maybe was a little red flag, I don't know. But we did follow with a Roman Catholic funeral. And, you know, that brought a lot of people, a huge amount of people. And, you know, that was sort of honouring her. For us, the traction of daily life, a dinner, you know, school, you know, going to the library, going for a walk every single day. In the beginning, I mean, in Athboy, I have the loveliest friends, you know, I'm a lasagna connoisseur.
Very good.
And, you know, actually taking me for a walk, you know, the sense of one lovely little lady called Linda used to walk me because you have to go through the town to get to the river area. And she would stolidly march beside me. And it was like fending off people who were kind of doing the, you know, the head tilt mm-hmm. or wanting to engage. And I was like, no, just taking her out for an airing. And that was absolutely marvellous in the early days. I think the worst thing was the first evening we'd been presented with sleeping pills by the doctor who came. And like idiots, we actually took them. And we don't really, you know, take any meds. Mm. So we woke up the next morning absolutely stupid to the fresh horror. And it was like, whatever happens, we will never, ever do that again. And I think in the unhelpful things that people said, or the glib things, or the slightly superior things, you know, my child had died in, you know, a road traffic accident or whatever, the sense that this was a lesser type of death, or the sense of I'm no longer jealous of you. Those kind of things served actually to strengthen.
I'm no longer jealous of you.
Yes.
Somebody said that.
Yes. And it was like, you are written off now. You know, this is your lot now.
Oh my
so that
God.
Was a shock. And it felt
so
like
you
a
talk about the difference. In, I remember with Jen, you talked about the difference between a clean death and a dirty death.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, the taint that suicide still has a huge stigma around it. And my daughter and I used to laugh. And we used to just kind of make a little bell. It's, you know, sort of motion if we were in a group or we felt that, you know, this is where this is going or what somebody has said. You are more sensitive. You are in a hypnoidal state around the time of a death. Your cortisol levels are up to here mm-hmm. and actual living is tough. So certainly, you know, being categorized we still have the feeling that suicide is not the same as a death from illness or, you know, someone who has been in some unfortunate accident. And you can understand that everybody's, you know, loss is very individual. But I do think we need to realise that it is a fact of life. It does happen. And sometimes you really actually don't know reasons. Mm-hmm. And I love the way Jen spoke about it and opened it up. And the comments, we've got so many wonderful comments. It was, you know, it was really heartening that in the 10 years since Carla died, there has been an opening, there has been a shift. And I liked the way Jen included, you know, stuff that we'd been talking about. Things to say, things not to say. How to be with somebody. It's a life skill, isn't it?
Yes, 100%. And I suppose, talk to me a little bit about your business and your career and your area of expertise helped you to cope, because you help couples, you counsel couples through incredibly difficult times, and how that aided you to get through. You said you never went for counselling yourself.
No,
do you feel that you were equipped in your own way?
Very much so. Very
okay.
much so.
Okay.
And I didn't want to be rehashing week after month type of thing. I wanted.
What about the rest of the family? Did they go through counselling?
Well, my daughter did do some, and she didn't actually find it incredibly helpful, to be honest. So certainly I would use EMDR, which is trauma release. It's very gentle and it's swift. So when I'm seeing people who have had a termination of pregnancy due to a fetal abnormality, which again can be very hidden, very, very difficult, hugely sorrowful and hugely traumatic, I will use EMDR, which is this eye movement, which gets your brain processing the trauma. Now, it's not expunging it, it's not demeaning it, it's not belittling it, but it's taking the raw emotion out of it so that you're not blindsided completely. And I believe that, you know, from the moment you're pregnant, that, you know, the two lines, that you're as pregnant as when you can't see your toes and you're kind of wishing that this was over. Mm-hmm. The projection of this little person you love already, mm-hmm. that, you know, is part of your life, that, you know, you really, it's huge. And I feel that it's, and actually I was talking to another researcher on another show, and I couldn't believe the lack of understanding, saying, how can you equate that loss with anybody you have known? Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, it's massive. And I think it blindsides people that, you know, going for IVF or, you know, trying to conceive, and the sense of, you know, getting past 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 9 weeks or 12 weeks and feeling safe, and to lose that pregnancy. And even the word loss sounds a bit careless. I lose brollies. I'm horrendous. I lose everything. But, you know, the sense of that, you know, born too soon, never born, that it's a huge trauma and we don't address it. We don't give people time. They're back at work. People are clucking around in the sense of, well, you can have another, keep going, do it quickly. And I think it's really tough for couples, and guys are the Cinderellas, both in the investigations, the diagnosis and the treatment of infertility. Mm-hmm. And we forget that the male factor is probably about 50% of miscarriage. Mm-hmm. Women internalize it because they are carrying this.
And it's like, for sure,
I failed to continue to carry this child. Mm-hmm. My body let us down. Mm-hmm. And the weight and the burden of grief and guilt and shame is huge. And that is something I'm so pleased that you are talking about. I think the younger women are doing such wonderful work in discussing this online, in blogs, podcasts, really not making it acceptable, but the feeling of not being alone is massive.
And I think that I understand now when you talk about the taboo of suicide or the taboo of miscarriage or the taboo, you know, it's that feeling, I suppose, of being alone and feeling different and having people give you the side, the side head tilt. You spoke there about, you know, people going back to work and you counselling people. How did you, when you went back to work and you were sitting there counselling a couple, was that very difficult? Was that a process that you had to go through yourself?
First of all, I'm not a counsellor.
Okay.
I'm a therapist, and it's really different. So you're very right. I'm lucky because, you know, as a therapist, I have supervision. So I have somebody that I must go to debrief. And it's very useful. And to be able to go in and give my full attention, my whole presence to someone else, their story, what they're experiencing.
How long did that take for you?
I really don't know. It was something I had to do because it was my work. We needed to eat. And
so you had to go back to work quite soon?
I went back very, very soon. And I'm not one bit sorry, because I think the traction of daily life is underrated. You know, when the planes fell out of the sky onto Lockerbie, and studies showed, you know, down the line, that actually those who had got on with life did a lot better than those who stayed going over and over and reliving it. So I do think that support within,
if you can do that, and if you can get yourself to that
exactly.
place. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know, there's a place for it. So I think, you know, it's flexibility. It's being gentle. Your horizon is in about here. So, you know, there's no one size fits all.
Do you still have days where you just close the door and wail your heart out?
No, no. I most certainly wouldn't. I wouldn't honour Carla's memory in that particular way. I mean, for a long time, there was a lot of music associated with her life that I wouldn't listen to. So I became quite up on pop because my younger daughter was coming up. I was very aware that I had this gorgeous younger daughter whose second mother had died. So her, you know,
there was 6.5 years between
them. Coming to her, it was a month before her 11th birthday. We had a party for her. You know, the oddness, we went to a wedding, a beautiful wedding of a wonderful couple who lost their little boy, Daniel. He was only just a few weeks old and I never got to meet him. So, you know, being aware as a midwife, as a nurse, that, you know, with life, we are very close to death. And, you know, I'm with Hobbes on what the human condition is like, nasty, short and brutish. So, you know, I think everything else is a bonus. I think a moment of connection, of warmth, of kindness, of being able to have water coming out of a tap, of being able, as I was, to be in a house by myself to cry when I needed to. I wasn't in a crowded apartment. I wasn't on the walking up from Syria, you know, that I had a lot of good things. So that sense of the blessings in my life, I was very much aware of. And I did my crying. And, you know, still there will be the odd little wobble. And I presume there always will be. You learn to live with loss.
You don't ever get over it.
No.
You just get...
It's part of who you are, really, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. You do a lot of work with the animal rescue, the Maura Egan. They have a kitten college.
Kitten college. No, actually, I don't. I'm a terribly lazy bitch, really. But they did a lot of work with me. I suppose the best thing about it was the fact that this little cottage outside Virginia, in the lee of the Hill of the Witch, where, you know, this incredible Neolithic tomb is, it's the most wonderful place, where her sons, you know, having bees, you know, shooting, fishing. It is the quaintest, sweetest, most magic little place. And I went along, and what I used to do was, for their thrift shop, they had me sorting books really badly. And, you know the bags that arrive that everybody turfs out
yes.
the house, clearing everything, you know, frightful rubbish, sorting things into what could be sold, what needed to be binned. So they were very kind and sweet, and they look after a lot of all kinds of animals and all kinds of humans who need a little help. So I must say that for me was really useful, because Maura is matter of fact, kind. She's not, you know, she just has an incredible way with her. So that was lovely.
We have had a massive reaction. Monica in Tullow says, Catherine, when you don't know what to say to a bereaved parent, then just say that. Being there for someone's grief is really helpful. Multiple miscarriages and no outcome. Friends with families exclude you from their family events.
Yes.
Says another listener around miscarriage. We say sorry. That's all. That's from Kathy. I mean, when you don't know what to say.
That's actually very good. You know, I found, again, I have a very, very black sense of humour. And humour was really useful.
In what way?
Because
I know you went over to Scotland.
I know.
Yourself and Suzanne. Tell me about that.
Is
bloody brilliant.
Isn't she?
Yeah.
Breath of fresh air.
So brilliant.
Positivity.
So if anyone doesn't know her, look her up.
Look her up on Instagram. She's a good follow.
She's great.
She actually got in touch, you know.
Did she?
Yes. And so she was very touched by Jen Hogan's piece in The Times. And it was really, really lovely. So certainly the, you know, the dark humour of the things people would say or how we would react together. And, you know, a lot of watching stand-up comedy. We loved Michael McIntyre and, you know, all the sort of Live at the Apollo people. Even in the darkest moment of watching with tears running down my face, to actually be where it wasn't serious was really, really useful.
Yeah.
And my own sense of humour that I think, you know, the fact that I had known Carla, we had had her in our lives, you know, people with recurrent miscarriage, the sense of, you know, going away for the weekend with the girls, you know, the spa weekend and said, well, you wouldn't know anything about kids, would you? And your time will come. I know, I'm certain it'll happen for you. That you can feel so excluded. I'm aware that not having children, dealing with infertility, is a huge, traumatic, ongoing grief and loss. And I always have been. So I'm very, you know, I shouldn't say glad, but the sense of that all I have ever done, I continued doing. I didn't need to do a volte face or a chainsaw. Gosh, I've been doing that wrong. That I really had it, that depth of understanding of loss of what hasn't been or hasn't happened yet for my clients.
And one of your clients, I visited Helena for a number of hypnotherapy for fertility sessions. They were wonderful. She helped me so much to prepare for my last IVF cycle. This resulted in our gorgeous baby boy. Helena's wit and sense of humour was so helpful in that time of need. Another listener, I experienced the same isolation when my husband left the family home after an affair. People can be very smug in their comments. The perfect life isn't so perfect now, but I learned who my true friends were.
Yes, the smugness, actually. And, you know, the sense of preordination. Well, our life is perfect because we're so perfect. And
it's Who the hell's life is perfect?
And exactly, it's like that. At any moment in a heartbeat, things can change. And I would like to say that something I find very useful as well, you know, humour and, you know, the way a lot of networking things are posh frocks and, you know, sort of one-upmanship. Well, Samantha Kelly's Women's Inspire Network, hilarious, down to earth, genuine help. Absolutely fantastic. And, you know, to this day, she's a good friend of mine.
Brilliant. Well, listen, you're a breath of fresh air, I have to say. Thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me today. And if you're affected by any of the issues that we've discussed, you can contact Pieta House on 1800 247 247 or text HELP to 51444, or you can contact the Samaritans either. Their free phone number is 116123. That's 116123. Or you can text 087-260-9090. And we'll put all that information up on our website as well. Helena, once again, thank you so much for coming in to chat to me.
My pleasure.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Conor Pope is in studio. Good afternoon, sir.
Happy Christmas, Catherine. Is it too soon?
No.
Yes, it is too soon. Of course it's too soon.
Well, I was looking at the few people, Pippa, and there was a couple of other people over the weekend putting up their Christmas tree. So I got himself up to the attic yesterday. Down came the Christmas tree. And even though the tradition is not until the toy show, but I'm kind of on the road all week. So we got the Christmas tree down, fought for about half an hour about who was doing what. And so we've got it up, but we've nothing on it.
I suspect like the rest of the nation, the rest of the nation is probably as saddened as me to hear that you've got a fake tree. What's wrong with the real trees?
The real Christmas tree went out with us 4 years ago because we have the dogs that kept peeing on it.
Yeah, that's an issue.
And then the Christmas needles that kept falling off it.
Yeah, that's also an
issue. And then the hassle of dealing with it afterwards, where we thought it was probably the most environmental as well.
Yeah, that's, yeah,
And it is a bit bah humbug, I know. He convinced me to do it because he was sick cleaning up and, you know, we were trying to figure out how you'd get the dog to stop peeing on the Christmas tree. And so that's why we have a fake tree.
Well, we've got a real tree. We'll probably get it next weekend.
Okay.
So, like, but you know.
But we can say Happy Christmas now?
Well, no, I'd say everyone's swearing at me now for even suggesting that you can. But the reason why I said it is,
well, we're blaming you. I was reading in the Irish Times today all about advent calendars and Christmas crackers.
Yeah. Well,
we're very much to blame.
The main feature in the Price Watch section today in the Irish Times is about waste over Christmas, and it really is phenomenal. And I think we're moving towards a much more environmentally conscious nation. Everyone's really concerned about single-use plastics, and there was talk about the latte levy and all that stuff. But yeah, when it comes to Christmas, we just go through such a vast amount of plastic. Like, we're going to pull around 1.5 million Christmas crackers collectively between us all over Christmas.
Are we not over Christmas crackers?
Each one of those crackers has a useless plastic toy that nobody wants and nobody will play with for more than 15 seconds. So it all has to come all the way from China. Then it has to be opened by us on Christmas Day, and then it goes into landfill. And like, you got to think, lads, we should have moved away from that. But anyway, I'm not going to lecture the nation on that, because the other thing I did
but
was
you're so right. I mean, even when you pull the Christmas crackers, even when before dinner's finished, they all go into a rubbish bag.
Gee, absolutely.
Everything.
Yeah, no, they're crack. And yeah. Everyone likes them, but they're such a waste. And then the other thing I did was edible advent calendars.
Go on, give us the best one.
Well, the best one was from Marks & Spencer, and they had a 750 euro, an advent calendar that was 750. And what I liked about it was really plain and simple on the outside. It was just baubles and a tree, and you'd open the 25 doors, and there was a different chocolate behind each door. And so there was kind of an element of surprise. The Cadbury one was just full of plastic. It was an Angry Birds themed advent calendar, because nothing says the baby Jesus like an Angry Birds themed advent calendar. So it had like a few plastic toys from Angry Birds, and then lots of the same Cadburys. And then there was one from Lidl, a cheese calendar. Now the only reason I bought
now it was, that sounds like my sort of calendar.
It was one of the worst things I've ever had in my life. And the only reason I bought it was so I could make baby cheeses jokes all the way through the review. But then I started eating the cheese, and there was one piece of cheese, and it'll live long my memory, Catherine. It was a Wensleydale and gingerbread cheese. I mean, have you ever heard of anything more vile than a Wensleydale and gingerbread cheese? And it had the texture was wrong, the taste was wrong. So it just made me really sad.
Have you ever had a ginger nut with cheddar or Wensleydale on it?
Well, I would, and I'd say it'd be a lot nicer than this cheese that I got, because not only was the combination wrong, it was also wrapped in this little sweaty plastic coffin. You know the kind of cheese that you get in an airplane.
Yeah.
So it was that kind of cheese, but now it was cheap. And it did make me
not necessarily the best move,
no.
Though. Okay, we have a question in from a listener. All the Black Friday ads have my head melted, Connor. Many of them have already started, and there are others that are promising massive savings over the next weekend. Are the sales real, and is now a good time to buy all my Christmas presents and maybe some other bits and pieces that I would normally wait for the January sales for?
Yeah, it is a bit of a head wreck time of the year, and the funny thing is that we're starting to look at Black Friday now like it's some kind of Christmas tradition, and the reality is it is not a Christmas tradition. In fact, it's less than 6 years old, and it was imported over to this part of the world by Asda, who are owned by Walmart. Now, it makes sense in the United States, because Black Friday traditionally comes on the day after Thanksgiving, and it's a day when most Americans are on holiday. So it's like their equivalent of St. Stephen's Day. So they have Thanksgiving, and then there's the Friday after Thanksgiving, and they all go shopping and they buy lots of stuff, and it makes sense in that part of the world because it has a cultural resonance there. It has no significance here. And what happened is in 2012, I think it was, Asda announced they're having a Black Friday sale in the UK. So there was riots in Asda shops up and down the UK, and people were fighting each other over flat screen tellies that were cheap. And then suddenly all the other retailers in the UK and then subsequently in this part of the world said, hang on, we'd like a bit of that. So then in the next couple of years, there was more Black Friday sales, and all the big retailers started to have Black Friday sales. And now virtually every shop, every hotel, every restaurant, everything has a Black Friday deal and a Black Friday sale. And the one thing I'd say to people is if you need a dishwasher, or if you need a washing machine, and you can buy the washing machine next Friday for 20% less than you can buy it for on Thursday or on Saturday, by all means buy it. But don't be going and buying stuff just because it's on sale, because that makes no sense. And what it ends up meaning is that you're spending money you mightn't have on stuff that you don't need. So that's kind of the same.
But for Christmas presents, if you can do your shopping online, or you can do...
Absolutely. But here's the other thing, that there's the British Consumer Watchdog, which, and lots of other organisations, every year they do these surveys on the Black Friday sales. And almost every year they kind of find out that, you know what, the sales really aren't that real. Because what retailers, and this is across the board, they'll say a massive Black Friday deal, everything 20% off. But in 3 weeks' time, things will be cheaper. Or maybe even 3 weeks ago, things were cheaper than they are in the Black Friday sales. So, you know, approach all of these things with a healthy degree of skepticism. Only buy the stuff if you think it's actually stuff that you want or that your family are going to love for Christmas. And don't be just suckered into it and buy the stuff just because there's this really hideously ugly yellow and black logo that seems to have been emblazoned across every single shop. And
but I have a friend who actually starts looking, you know, about 3 weeks ago, and she has figured out, and she's looked and she's watched the prices on various sites, and for her now she's looking forward to getting going.
And if that works for you, go for it.
That works for you. Connor Pope, thanks as always. Back after this.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
We have some live music in studio. Keela are here, lads. We have a packed studio. They are here ahead of their big gig at the National Stadium on December 21st. Great to see you all. We're talking Black Friday. Connor Pope has you all riled up, but we'll talk a bit more about that. You're going to play Put the Oar first, so take it away.
Yeah.
Amazing, lads. That was fantastic. And the guys will be playing again for us before the end of the show. And now I am very much looking forward to our next chat as a first-time mom, I suppose, really, because no matter how prepared you think you are, you haven't a rashers. That was my experience anyway. And a new online course, which is all evidence-based information aimed at addressing knowledge gaps that we may have, breaking the silence around embarrassing or sensitive health issues, which our bodies may go through afterwards. So that is all now available. And the woman behind it is Dr. Deirdre Daly, who is assistant professor in midwifery at Trinity. I'm also joined by two moms who took part in the study, which resulted in the course, Ellen McAvoy and Moira McLaughlin. Were the guinea pigs and part of the whole process. So first of all, Deirdre, I'll come to you. This online resource is based on the MAMMI study, M-A-M-M-I. Tell us what it is and what it's all about.
Okay, well, the online course is called WHAM.
Okay.
Women's Health After Motherhood.
Yeah. And then the study is
the MAMMI study. And MAMMI stands for Maternal Health and Maternal Morbidity in Ireland. And morbidity means a health problem or anything that's going to have a negative effect on the woman's health or life, well-being. I started back in 2011 for my PhD. And I started because I'd been working as a midwife out in one of the community clinics in Dublin. I met a woman who had had health problems. I went looking for the amount of women that would suffer from a health problem like urinary incontinence or something in Ireland, and discovered that there was absolutely no data collected on women's health once they leave the maternity.
Nothing.
In Ireland. No. No data collected and reported. Now, we have fantastic data during pregnancy, during labour, during mm-hmm. childbirth, but none afterwards. Mm-hmm. So we started the MAMMI study, and we started it in one hospital, recruited over 5 years in three hospitals, and we recruited a total of 3,047 first-time mothers.
Okay. And with this study back then, had you planned how long it was going to go on, how long the study was going to take, how many years, or had you even got that?
Oh, the dream was, well, we knew at the very beginning, that we were going to follow them up at 12 months postpartum.
Okay.
But the dream and the vision was to keep on going. So we're now on the 5-year follow-up. And the new vision is for get more money to do the 10-year follow-up and then the 15 and then the 20. So it's, as I keep saying to them, it's to menopause and beyond.
Okay. There's no getting out now, girls, is what she's saying.
They're really committed. I mean, they will tell you themselves, I mean, what the surveys are like. Mm-hmm. But at 3 months postpartum after first-time motherhood, you know, in that awful tiredness, exhaustion, am I doing okay? Mm-hmm. The retention rates were about 90%.
Okay. All right. So, Ellen, I'll come to you first. What did you find most beneficial about the study, or were you surprised at the questions that it drew up for you? How soon were you answering the questions? How did you get involved? Tell us all.
Well, I got involved because I just am a serial participator. Everyone will tell you that. If there's something to be volunteered for, I'm putting my hand up. So I didn't really expect anything to come back out of it. I did the one while I was still pregnant, you know, was kind of like, whoa, there's a lot of questions in this. And
like what?
Didn't think much about it. I suppose there's a lot of questions about your mental health. There's questions about your physical health. I remember sending one of the studies back late because I didn't have a weighing scales that had a battery in it. And one of the team phoned me up and was like, are you okay? Like, we're concerned for you. And it was one of the only phone calls that I got from, you know, medical representatives that I felt that someone actually genuinely cared. And they noticed that I was missing. And I think that was the one that was, is it 9 months postpartum? Mm-hmm. But yeah, the questions are very, very, they're invasive to a certain extent. You know, they ask about, you know, your bladder control and the other end and the rest of it. But, you know, your mental health and generally just a kind of a check in. The same things that you would ask your friends, maybe not in quite that much detail, but mm-hmm. really a sense of how are you? How are you going? You know,
because we don't ask ourselves those questions, because when you are a new mom, your whole world is turned upside down and the focus is entirely on the baby. Yeah. It's like happy, healthy baby. And there you go for your 6 week checkup and the nurse comes out, the public health nurse comes out, checks the baby. You know, so it's all the focus is on the baby. And was this the first time that you were answering questions?
Yeah,
about
so that's
you?
What I was saying that earlier on was I remember going into the 6 week checkup thinking, right, this is mommy's MOT. I'm going to get my, you know, validity certificate and back on the road. I'll be back to normal. This is the big tick and I'm going to feel like myself after this. I had to beg to get my stitches checked. I had a second degree tear and I had to really convince the nurse that it was worthwhile to check my stitches. She was kind of going, if you don't have pain, you're grand. And I was like, no, I want to make sure that everything is A-OK down there. And then the study came in the 3 months postpartum. And it was all the questions that I felt like I should have been asked.
Yeah.
You know, how are you going to the toilet? Is everything okay? How do you feel in yourself? I think there's even questions about, you know, how are you sleeping? How's your relationship?
Yes.
You know, and that was one of the big things for me postpartum was I felt like my relationship with everyone was falling apart. And the one that I did not want to let go was my marriage. But I just felt that communication was so difficult. 15 months postpartum, I eventually got diagnosed with postnatal anxiety. And it was all down to that. But, you know, I would credit my diagnosis to having filled out the mammy study. And it was a slow but sure process. I had filled out all of the studies and plus a couple of months before I actually took myself to go get help.
So it gave you time to reflect. You still needed time after that, after answering the questions, to make that move and make that decision. Moira, what was your experience of the study?
Well, similar to Ellen, I really think that the study asked questions that nobody else was asking. I definitely feel one of the things that my GP said to me at, I think, the 6 week check was that it's very important to be a healthy mother as well for your baby. Mm. But I think at the same time, she didn't go into the same level of detail as what the mammy study did. And I think that just prompted me to just kind of think about myself, because you really put your finger on the main point that it is really about the health of your baby after having had a baby. Mm. And everyone asks questions. Everyone expects you to kind of bounce back to normal. I think expectation.
God, I hate that phrase.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez, I hate it. Bounce back.
Yeah. It's,
I mean, who bounces back?
Our whole view of it is skewed, in my opinion. The expectations that are put on mothers are huge. You're expected to bounce back to normal. You're expected to be really happy being a new mother, which most women are, but that doesn't change the fact that it is sometimes difficult and you need support.
Mm.
But the expectations on mothers are huge. But on the flip side of that, women aren't really allowed to expect very much. We're kind of told that as long as you have a healthy baby, you should be fine and you should tolerate anything else. Whereas we need to be a bit more honest about what's normal for women after having had a baby, and we need to provide more supports for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the mammy study really did shine a light on that for me, that the health of a mother is also extremely important. And it doesn't in any way diminish the fact that you also value the health of your baby and you are extremely happy to be a mother. But you are also important yourself.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, when I had Ellie and people said, oh, you know, you bounce back, or on social media. And basically that was, you've lost weight.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of signified to me. And yes, I did, not by, you know, by trying hugely. It was just that's what happened to me and to my body. But I didn't feel like I'd bounced back anywhere. I couldn't bounce up or down or in or out. And for me, it was, I'll never forget getting home from the hospital, and I had an emergency C-section. So she was born a couple of weeks early and it was all very, very sudden. I had my maternity leave planned out. I had the nails booked at 4 o'clock. Yeah. I went in for my checkup and didn't come out, and that was it. And being in that love bubble for the first couple of days, and I felt that, and I felt that connection, and I felt amazing, and I felt, and it was incredible. And then the day I got home, when I was on my own in the house, I just felt a complete lack of, I don't even know what it was. It's like I was looking at her going, she doesn't feel like mine. It was really strange. And when I was very lucky, my best friend had a baby at the same time as me. So I was able to talk it out with her. She'd had a kid before. She'd had a baby before. She's like, this is normal. Anything you're feeling now is normal. If you're feeling it, it's normal. But it was to be able to acknowledge that mm-hmm. and accept it. And eventually, you know, after the couple of days, a couple of weeks, it came right. But it was a worrying time. I won't lie to you, you know. And I suppose having something like this where you can have an online resource, because all of this study now, as you said, Deirdre, it's a resource that's now available free of charge.
Yep. It's WHAM, Women's Health After Motherhood. And I should say it's available in English. It's available in Spanish. And in 2000 and in January, it'll be available in Dutch as well.
Great.
So, it very much built on the findings from the MAMI study, because these women, we shared the findings in 2016, 17, 18 with the women. And we set up a public participation with women in research initiative with the women.
Mm.
And I remember very well, and it was Ellen actually at the very first PPI meeting that said, you have to do something.
Mm.
You have to do something to make a difference. So we started applying for more money and got money from different bodies to set up WHAM.
Mm.
And week one is all about your physical health, maternal health.
So it was with this findings from the mothers, you have gotten physiotherapists, psychiatrists and other experts in mental health, sexual health, everybody yep. involved yep. in this to create this,
yes,
this resource.
Create resources.
Mm.
And it's videos.
Amazing.
It's downloadable. Some of them are editable. There's audios from the women in every week. So they're at the women's voice at the beginning and at the end of every week's learning to tell you their tips. Week one is all about your health, maternal health, and challenges the myths.
Mm.
Your body will be back to normal.
Mm.
6 weeks. there's a downloadable interactive infographic that tells you what isn't normal. It tells you what's common but not normal. And it tells women what they can do to help themselves and how to and when to ask for help.
Mm.
Week two is all about urinary incontinence and your pelvic health. Wonderful guided pelvic floor muscle exercises. They're fantastic.
Yes.
Week three is all about mental health. Mm. Particularly anxiety and depression, and that's two mental health experts. And there's a gorgeous piece in there as well on advocating for yourself. And week four then is all about the relationships. So it's your social relationships, intimate relationships, like your sexual intimacy, and then a bit on domestic violence written by one of our experts, Sarah Benson, who's director of Women's Aid.
Mm.
And there's a lovely bit there as well as from Ireland's only clinical sexologist, Emily Power-Smith, on choosing lubricants.
Okay, okay. So, and I know there's like it's a vast array of subjects then. Were there any specific subjects that came through again and again and again from mothers that you saw that were very prevalent?
They would be the key ones. It was the yeah. physical health stuff that nobody talked about. So there's urinary incontinence in there, leaking urine. There's also fecal incontinence, so leaking bowels when they don't mean to it as well.
Mm.
Mental health issues was big, and not just depression. It was anxiety as well.
Mm.
More often than not, what women had were one or some of these health problems. So it wasn't just one of them. And what they really, really needed was some place that they could go for this reliable, trustworthy source of information all in one place, and they could trust it.
Mm.
I think there was an overwhelming sense as well that we wanted language that we could use. So instead of going in and feeling like you needed the midwife or the doctor to answer all of the questions, you know, just tell me all the things. You wanted to kind of go in with a little bit of something so that you could actually ask the questions that were meaningful to you, because not every mother has the same questions.
Mm.
And like this sense of going from being me to being mother, you know, that always got me. There was two things when the doctor or the GP would go, and how's mum? And you kind of go, oh, I don't like it. I don't like what you're saying. Or the other one was the head tilt and the, oh, you're a first time mum, though. Like as if you'll learn as
yeah,
you go
yeah.
along. But how am I meant to learn? I'm asking you for the help was really what we were all crying out and saying was, we need to know more so that we can get more.
Yes.
And that was really what we wanted from the next phase.
Well, clearly, Moira, from this, it's like, you know, we have to ask the question, does post-maternity care for women go on long enough? I mean, clearly it
no,
doesn't.
Probably not. I think what's important,
because you have three children.
I have three kids. They're 6, 4, and 1.5. And I think one thing that stuck out for me when filling out the 5-year follow-up, I had three kids by the time I filled out the 5-year follow-up. My youngest was 3 months old. And one thing that stuck out for me was that I had grown in so much confidence. And I think that only happened with experience. I think your first time around, you're listening to all the anecdotal information that you're hearing from everybody, all the advice that's really well-meaning, but it's not always evidence-based.
Yes.
And even though it's good to chat and it's great to have support around you, it is really important to have somewhere to go to get evidence-based information.
Yes.
And women's experience has to be valued. And I don't think we do that enough. I think sometimes once the baby arrives, the focus shifts just a little bit too much. And it doesn't mean that the focus should come off the baby entirely. It just means it should be maybe spread a little bit more evenly to ensure that every mother is also looked after.
Okay. Well, listen, it's been so interesting having a chat with you guys today, to Ellen, to Moira, to Dr. Deirdre Daly. It sounds like this survey is going to roll on and keep going.
Well, when they, and it's all thanks to women that we're this far.
Because it's great.
They're committed to the study.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, you can find out more about the online resource at www.futurelearn.com/courses/womenshealthaftermotherhood. And we will put that information up on our Fantastic. Website as well. Thanks a million, ladies.
Thank you very much.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
So Keila are all back in studio, ready to play some more amazing tunes. And I did say, lads, you have a big gig coming up at the National Stadium on December 21st. But first of all, tell us, you're just back from Belgium. How was it?
Belgium was great.
Yeah?
Six dates. Bang, bang, bang. Belgium is great. It's only the size of Munster, so you can stay in the middle and then travel an hour.
Okay.
Pretty much to every gig, so it's very easy.
Is there a big Irish contingent out there as well? There would be.
No, it was mostly Belgians that came.
Okay.
Yeah, some Dutch. We had a crew that drove from Asturias in northern Spain to catch three of the gigs.
Amazing.
Yeah. That's
fabulous.
Dedication.
Well, listen, it is a special time of year to do a big gig, Rossa. December 21st, everyone wants to go, you know, get out, have the Christmas night. Will it be Christmassy? Oh, well,
of course
it'll
be Christmassy. Yeah. Well, we've been doing this for years, so you know it's a big, wonderful kind of gathering. A lot of people get home, you know, for Christmas, and it's a place where a lot of people like meeting up. And they know if they go to the Keila gig, they'll meet all their mates, and you know, and sometimes they'll bring all their mates anyway, just to be there with all of them. So it's a fabulous one.
And we were joking there during the break about Black Friday and everybody doing Black Friday. And you, since you went up there, you had a cup of coffee. Are you doing, what's the Black Friday?
Yeah, so this is the plan now. Thanks to your researcher there, she gave me great ideas. Not to give money away to people who have money, but to give away money to people who don't have money in their charities. So we're thinking of, this is the idea. So we're going to give money away from everybody. Everyone who buys a ticket at full price, we give money to this charity, the Inner City Help Home or Homeless Help.
Inner City Helping the Homeless.
Helping Homeless, that's them, yeah.
Fantastic.
So I think that'll be a good one.
That's a great idea. And you know what? It's like it's one of those that when you sit down, you don't have to think about it too long. You know, it just kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it's the big issue of the day, and it continues to be, and it might continue to be. If we keep voting the way we do, but that's my party political broadcast.
That's right. And speaking of Christmas, what's the crack? What do you, are you all after the gig? Are you back to work straight after Christmas? Do you get some downtime?
We've a few gigs after Christmas, and you know more than that.
You can go in Munro's and then New Year's Day, so it's kind of quiet between Christmas and New Year.
Which is
and
nice.
In January, there's. Down, that's mostly when the downtime happens.
Well, we're off to New Orleans in January.
It's at the end of January.
Oh, okay.
That's January.
And is that where you're working on the new album? Because you're working on a new album for 2020, am I right?
Yeah, we're working on that all the time. We just have the first single out called Coursey Gras. So that's... And that'll hopefully hit number one, as it doesn't anymore, because there's no number one anywhere. You can be number one in someone's bedroom, and but hopefully anyway, there'll be loads of downloads of that. But the idea is that we're going to be just pushing away and recording, trying to find time, and eventually put an album together. But you know, I suppose the old way, release a song every time it's done. And then eventually gather it all up into an exhibition and present it.
Presented, yeah. You said before that the band works together like a bag of bees. What a brilliant explanation. Brian's looking at me going, did we actually say that?
Brian, you're herding a bag of cats.
Explain
Brian,
that to
Brian
me.
Is the herder.
The herder of bees. I'm a bee gatherer. And it's actually or herding chickens. It's like herding chickens. putting the band. There's nine of us on the road.
Okay, so you're so all bringing your own bit. Who's where? Yeah, who's coming on? Who's coming off?
Yeah, that kind of thing. So brilliant. It's normal.
Well, listen, you are absolutely fabulous. I always love listening to you. So what are you going to play us out with today?
Her Royal Waggledy Toes.
Her Royal Waggledy Toes. This I love. Go for it. Toes. That was amazing. Well done, lads. Thank you so much. That was Keela. And that is all I've got time for today. Mary Wilson is next on Drive Time. Thanks a million. Have a great afternoon. The Radar.